have a blessing coming into our own home for in the next week or so. I have my nephew coming to visit us, our 14-year-old nephew visiting us for a few weeks. Now, of course, when you're used to living a certain way and you bring a new person into your home, you kind of want to at least spruce it up a bit, right? And so I'm going through the process of cleaning house. And so what do? First of all, you try and get rid of what you really didn't think about as junk, but now you take a new look at it and say, okay, that needs to go. Maybe you take another look at your surroundings, like, okay, I need to spruce this up a bit. I need to clean this up a bit. And so I am actually now going through the process of getting everything ready for our visitor, throwing some things out, doing some extra cleaning, trying to really make it better, even than what I'm usually working there, not living there. Now, it's a shame that you got to do all this and you don't do it just for yourself, but you do it for someone else. However, when we think about this phrase, cleaning house, it also has another connotation. When things are out of order, we need to clean house. Things could be out of order emotionally, or mentally, or spiritually. Whatever those things are in your own home, your figurative home, maybe it's time to clean house. Maybe it's time to get some things in order. Maybe it's time to reevaluate some things and put everything where it needs to be and get rid of the things that might be holding you back. Cleaning house. I submit to you that in our passage today, I think Jesus is doing a little house cleaning. Jesus is doing some house cleaning. And the house is focusing, of course, on the temple. The text for today is John chapter 2, verses 13 through 25. Though I'm going to focus primarily on chapters 2, verses 13 through 22. Now, when I look at this passage, there are so many layers that I didn't really see when you just look at it casually. And I hope to unfold those for you, to unpack that for you today. So the question I think about, and the title of this message is The Cleansing of the Temple. What is the significance of this cleansing? Why does Jesus need to clean house? And a couple of things I hope that this will help you to think about is the significance of the temple. And we're going to think about the temple in the Old Testament, the temple in Jesus' time, and the temple today. And what does it say about Jesus? What does the cleansing of the temple say about Jesus? So, let's take a look at John chapter 2, and I want to read in your hearing verses 13 through 17. John chapter 2, verses 13 through 17. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume you." So let's look at the setting. Now, of course, if you read chapter 2 of the Gospel of John, this happens after the miracle where Jesus turns water into wine at the wedding ceremony, at the wedding feast. And so now from Cana of Galilee, he goes to Jerusalem. And so the setting is actually the temple courts. This is the outer court of the temple. And here we see buying and selling of cattle, sheep, and doves. Now, of course, some of you may wonder, why is this going on? Well, in the brilliance of the Jewish leaders, since people need to bring a sacrifice, why not go ahead and sell them the sacrifice at the temple courts? Let's just make it easy for them. So that way you go ahead and sell it, then you bring it in, get a sacrifice. It's all just an easy transaction for you right there. Well, let's also look at the occasion. The occasion is the Passover. Now, if you recall, the Passover celebrates an important event in the history of Israel. Remember that Israel was in Egyptian slavery. Moses had already come to Pharaoh several times and asked that he would let the Israelites go in order that they may worship God. And of course, he refused, and there were 9 plagues. But the 10th plague would kill the firstborn of everyone in the land. Note that it wasn't just the Egyptians, but it would kill everyone in the land. But for Israel, the way of salvation from this plague was through sacrifice. That is, each household had to kill a lamb and paint its blood over the door of the house. And then each Israelite will remain in that house so that when the plague came, it passed over the house with the blood on it. So that none of the firstborn within that house would die. I hope you've gotten a chance to watch the Ten Commandments. I think it's an interesting way that they depict this with the shadow coming and it passing through and around the houses with the blood on it. And so the sacrificial blood saved the life of the firstborn children in each house. And then this was to be a reminder to them that they were to celebrate this every year, to celebrate God's deliverance of them from Egyptian slavery. This was the redemptive act of God in the Old Testament, which they should always look back to and say, this is how God redeemed us, and this is why we serve God. So, the problem here. Because to me, it almost seems logical, maybe, that these animals would be there for sacrifice. Now, why would there be a problem? Some might propose that there might have been some dishonest gain, that maybe those in the temple courts were overcharging for the animals and trying to get as much money as they can and depriving the poor. But that's kind of unlikely, because when you read the text, it indicates that the problem is something different. The problem is the very presence of the people in the temple courts. The problem is that the significance of the temple is being violated. The temple, if we recall, is the place of worship. The temple is the place of God's presence. In the tabernacle, when they were moving around after they were delivered from Egypt, the tabernacle would be the place where the Shekinah glory would fall onto the tabernacle to symbolize God's presence. The Ark of the Covenant would rest inside the holiest place where the high priest would enter in once a year to sprinkle the blood of the atonement, the atonement for sin, on the Ark of the Covenant to signify atonement. The Ark of the Covenant and the blood would show that sin had been forgiven by sacrifice. It is the most holy place. When we think about Solomon, when he built the temple, the Shekinah glory filled the temple so much and so thick that people began to pass out. And in Ezekiel, when this relationship with God and his people had been severed and had been damaged because of sin, the glory of God is seen as departing from the temple and departing from Israel. However, this outer course has a special significance for the Gentiles. The Gentiles could not go any further than the outer courts. So if you have a Gentile convert who wants to worship the one true God, that Gentile convert must worship in the outer courts. But guess what? The outer courts were full of animals and money changers. So the very place where Gentiles could worship had been filled. And it prevented even them from worshiping. So the temple is a place of worship. It's a place of God's presence. It's also a place of sacrifice. It is in the temple that you will see the sacrifice happen that would atone for sin, that would bring new fellowship between the people and God. It is also a place of prayer. In Isaiah 56:7, it's quoted as a house of prayer. In Mark, Matthew, and Luke, that particular verse is quoted when he cleanses the temple because it is a house of prayer. So the temple is a place that is being treated as common, a place that is not sacred, a place that is not set apart to God. Keep that in mind for a minute, a place that is common and not set apart to God. It's become a place of financial trade. And Jesus is in conflict with the religious leaders about the status of the temple. So what's Jesus' reaction? Well, of course, as you can see, he drives everybody out with a whip. Now, I think sometimes the imagery we get can be sanitized. Jesus is hardcore here. Yeah. Jesus is about business here. Yeah. He is getting the folks out. Jesus is not playing around. And that's not something we think about when we hear Jesus. We think about the mild and meek Jesus, but make no mistake, when you deal with something in his house, when you deal with something that is coming against God, Jesus will take care of it. Yeah. And so let's make sure that we understand that Jesus is dealing with business here. He turns over the tables. And then the disciples have this remembrance of this quote, of this quote from the Psalms. It's actually Psalm 69, verse 9, but I'm going to read verses 7 through 9. And this is David speaking, and he says, "For I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a foreigner to my own family, a stranger to my own mother's children. For zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who insult you fall on me." Now, isn't it interesting that David is the one who's speaking, but Jesus puts himself in the place of the writer? I'm going to get to that for a moment, but let's look at the overall picture here. The overall picture is that Israel is in the wrong. The leadership of Israel has made this decision to allow these animals and these potential sacrificial animals to come into the temple in order that they may be sold. Now, it's too strong maybe to say that they're defiling the temple, but they have lost sight of the intended purpose of the temple. So the reaction and the intensity of Jesus' reaction, knowing his character, points to the value of the temple. Worship, and not only the service of worship, but the heart of worship, is what is to be done in the temple. And notice how Jesus uses this phrase, "my Father's house." The significance of this, particularly in the Gospel of John, is it points to the relationship between Jesus and his Father. In fact, I believe this is probably the first time that we see that Jesus refers to him as my Father in the Gospel of John. And we see throughout the narrative of John that Jesus repeatedly talks about the relationship between his father and himself, which also reveals something very special about the identity of Jesus himself. And in John chapter 5, Jesus says that he does what the Father does. He says his Father is doing because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he does. And he goes on to talk about that the Father raises the dead and gives life. Even the Son does the same thing. So the Son also raises the dead. In John chapter 10, it talks about how he and the Father are one. In verse 25, did I tell you, but you did not believe, the works I do in my Father's name testify about me, but you do not believe because you are not truly my sheep. And then these are the comforting verses that we should be familiar with. My sheep listen to my voice, and I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life and they shall never perish. No one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. And no one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. And then that last phrase, I and my Father are one. Yes. Or to his disciples in the upper room. In John 14, if you have seen me, you've seen the Father. All right. And so we see throughout these passages, and this passage in John 2 is the first hint when he says, my Father, that John develops this identity between the Father and the Son. And so why is this important? Because not only is the Son and the Father related, but the temple as the Father's house is special. In fact, the psalmist uses the term zeal, talking about excitement, energy, reverence, passion for his house. And yet the people who are supposed to be God's people are treating it as a common thing in order just that they might just sell animals and conduct commerce there. So I submit to you that Jesus clears the temple because it is his Father's house and is being used as a financial center and has lost its true significance as a place of worship of the living God. And this is my first point. Jesus cleanses the temple because worship is not the priority. Jesus cleanses the temple because worship is not the priority. So after Jesus cleanses the temple, the Jewish leaders confront him. And in this encounter, he reveals something important about himself. And I want to read in your hearing verses 18 through 22. The Jews then responded to him, what sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. They replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple and you're going to raise it in 3 days. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the words that Jesus had spoken. So the Jewish authorities bring out this question. By what authority do you do this? Now, most likely when they ask this, they're asking about a sign. What is the sign that you want to show us? Now, of course, we can recall in the other Gospels that Jesus says a wicked generation is always asking for a sign. That's right. However, what I find ironic is that as you read through the Gospel of John, you will see up to 7 signs that confirm who Jesus is. Right. In other words, in the miracle of the changing water into wine in Cana of Galilee in chapter 2, in chapter 4, we have the miracle of the healing of the centurion's son. In chapter 4, it's the miracle of the healing of the lame man at the river, at the pool. We have also the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 people, after which he says, I am the bread of life. We have the miracle of the healing of the man born blind, before which he says, I am the light of the world. And then we have the miracle of raising of Lazarus from the dead. And then he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Yes. My brothers and sisters, they have a lot of signs, but guess what? Even when they see those signs, they do not believe. In fact, the Jewish leaders would become more antagonistic after the last two signs.
That's right.
So they became more set in their opposition. They would not obey or consider any signs. Well, consider Jesus' answer to them when they say, by what authority do you have? And his answer is, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it. Now, they look at the temple behind them and is like, you crazy. This is absurd.
Yeah.
And then they start to think in their heads. You know, it's like, look how long it took to build this temple. King Herod had been on a project to renovate this thing. Now, he began in 20 BC. By the time Jesus comes on the scene, it's 26 or 27 AD. That is about 46 years. By the way, they weren't finished. It wasn't finished until 64 AD. So they still had another 40 years to go. And think about this. Think about the effort that it took. A commentator noted this, and I'm just going to just read a couple of things to you. In order to ensure purity, 1,000 priests were trained as stone cutters and architects. A total of 18,000 men worked full time until it was finished in 64 AD. Some stones weighed as much as 70 tons, and they can still be seen today as walls holding up the Temple Mount. But we have to know, and we get this sense, especially after the editorial comment, that Jesus is not speaking of that physical temple. Jesus is talking about himself. We see the same kind of message given in Mark, Matthew, and Luke, where it says the only sign you will be given is the son of Jonah. So just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and the night, so the Son of Man will be in the earth for 3 days and three nights. So this was recalled after the resurrection. So this is what was said. Now let's think about the importance of it. First of all, we can see that Jesus' authority is confirmed by the resurrection.
That's right.
And maybe this should help us to remember why we celebrate Resurrection Sunday every year. Because it is the time where we see Jesus lives and his authority is confirmed. I think about Matthew 28 when he says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth.
Yes.
His authority is confirmed because of the resurrection. Notice also that because of the resurrection, the focus moves from the temple to himself.
Yeah.
The focus is no longer what is happening at the temple, but what is going on with Jesus. And he proves this by what John would call his glorification,
yeah,
the matrix of his death, resurrection, and ascension. For the Jewish authorities, only the resurrection to them would be the sign of his ultimate authority. But not only can we see that the resurrection is a sign, but also there is a new sphere of worship. There is a new place of worship. Formerly, worship, sacrifice, and God's presence was centered at the Jewish temple.
Yes.
Now, the synagogues would be a place of religious teaching, but the sacrifice, the worship, and God's presence is in the temple. That's going to change. And we could see a hint of it in Jesus' discussion with the woman, with the Samaritan woman. In John chapter 4, starting at verse 19, it relates this debate among Jews and Samaritans about where they should worship, either at Mount Gerizim near Shechem or in Jerusalem. The question is asked in starting in verse 19. She says, sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshiped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. And I want to skip down to verse 23. So in verse 23, yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth. And so true worship happens in spirit and in truth. In other words, true worship is genuine worship, worship from the heart. And by the way, this is confirmed because in AD 70, the temple is destroyed. There's no longer a temple to go to. However, after Jesus is glorified, there's no longer a need for a temple. There's no longer a need for a temple because Jesus is the final sacrifice. So there's no need for a temple for sacrifice. Also, Jesus' death signals a new covenant, that the temple is of the old covenant. But now there's a new relationship. There's a relationship of God, the Spirit, who works in each and every person, so that we have relationship, not by going to the temple, but because God has come into us. Yes. And so now we have the presence of God within us. And then bringing the sacrifice is a large part of worship, but now we acknowledge Jesus as the true sacrifice. And so in that time, the presence of God is in Jesus. John chapter 1:14, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So Jesus, by his resurrection, shows that he is the new temple, the place of sacrifice, worship, and God's presence. And that's point number two. By his authority, Jesus is the sign that he is the new sacrifice. I'm sorry, the new temple. He is the new temple. So the Gospel of John focuses on Jesus and his work. Now, what I want to do is to move beyond the Gospel of John for just a few minutes. As we move from the Gospel of John into the epistles and into after the time of Jesus, Jesus' time on earth, because we know that after the resurrection, he ascends, and when he ascends, he sends his spirit on the whole church. And so, Jesus, by his sacrifice, by his ascension, and by sending the spirit, has done something greater. In fact, Jesus even uses this phrase, greater things you will do, because the Spirit comes. Because the most astounding truth that I can think of now is that now God dwells in us. Yes. Now we are the dwelling place of God. Yes. Now, of course, we can say that individually, because we each one of us is dwelt with the Spirit. That is a sign of our salvation. But what I want to focus on is corporately, because corporately together, as a community, together as people of God, we are indwelt by the Spirit. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 16 through 17, after Paul lays out that we as the people are and talking about the fact that the church has been divided and giving this idea of judgment through fire, he's making the point that we together are the temple of God. In verse 16, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple, you being plural here, yes, and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst, plural. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person. For God's temple is sacred, and you together are that temple. Yes. We collectively are the temple of God. Yes. And so it refers to the factions and the fighting that is happening in Corinth. And note this, the destruction of this temple is going to bring God's judgment. The destruction of the community of believers, us as a community, brings God's judgment. Oh, if you don't believe me, we can take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 15 through 16. Now, this is the text that talks about being unequally yoked, but notice that it can have application for both individuals and for us collectively. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers, for what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? Or what does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? For we are the temple of the living God, as God has said. So both individually and corporately, we can come to the conclusion, particularly corporately, that we, the church, is the temple of God. Now, let me clarify something with you. When I say we, I'm not talking about this physical structure. I'm not talking about this building.
That's right.
In other words, it's kind of improper to say, I'm going into the temple.
That's right.
No, the temple is not the physical building. The temple is the community.
Yes.
The temple is the community of saved believers. We are the temple. And so when you come to the temple, you are coming among God's people. While we are here to worship, worship is not limited to physical space. But remember, worship occurs in spirit and in truth.
Yes.
True worship is of the heart. We have all believed in the sacrifice of Christ. God's spirit resides with us collectively. So think about this. We have the place of worship, which is true worship from the heart. The place of sacrifice, we collectively confirm Jesus and confess Jesus as Lord. And hopefully we're still making individually a living sacrifice to the Lord daily. And then we are the place where God resides. We, as the people, collectively are God's temple, which is point number three. The church is the new temple, the temple of the Holy Spirit. Now, the more I thought about this, the more it troubled me. Because remember why Jesus started to cleanse the temple? Because they looked at it as common. Because it was not sacred. My brothers and sisters, how would Jesus be cleansing us today if he were to come in here? In other words, if we are God's people, how should we be displaying ourselves? If we are God's temple, are we truly a place of worship? Can people see us and see us as a welcoming place to worship the living God? And of course, I'm talking about Tabernacle Community Church, but I'm talking bigger than this. When we think about all churches here. So think about this. What are some things that dishonor the temple? Factions and strife. People dishonoring one another. Pettiness. Jealousy. Quest for power. If we think about the way that we have gone about our politics and how that has divided us. When we think about favoritism in the church. And just this idea of favoritism, it violates that we are many members but one body in Christ. And that each member is important.
Yes.
And think about this too, when one member suffers, all members suffer. We all are messed up. So if someone is suffering in our body today, if there's someone here who is being overlooked or ignored, what does that say about our temple priorities? So what would a cleansing look like today? A couple of things to think about as I close. What are some individual practices that we can use to build up the temple? Meaning building up our community. First of all, we can be each using our spiritual gifts. And think about this. If you are not using your spiritual gifts, it's not just something that's hurting you. It's hurting all of us. Because we are one body and we are missing something from you. You have something so important that can bless all of us. And our spiritual gifts are not meant for us, but they're meant for the whole body. They're meant to bless each other. Think about this. Your involvement in the lives of people. My brothers and sisters, you are so important. And you have something significant to add. And we miss you when you're not here. In fact, we miss you in ways that we don't always understand. If God has placed you here, if God has ordained that you would be here at this time, then you are needed. And what's more, you need us. You need us to minister to you. And then, are you participating in a small group? That is one way that you can bring even more health to the overall body. So individually and collectively, I would ask you, pray for God's vision that our community will reflect the reality that God dwells in us. Yes. Jesus cleansed the temple because it was being used as a place that was common and not for worship. Jesus, by cleansing the temple, points to himself as the true temple. Yes. And then by the sending of the Spirit, he makes a new temple out of the church, that we are now the place of God. Today, we are his temple. Let us act as a temple, a place where God dwells, and that people, even those who are not believers, can see it. Can see that there's a difference between what's going on here and what's going on elsewhere. Let them see a people who are devoted and reflective of the sacrifice of Christ and present ourselves as a living sacrifice. And let us reflect that we are a place of true worship. Amen. As we close, I would ask you to continue to be faithful in your giving. And I would like to just go ahead and give the benediction. So can we stand together? As you go out, I pray that the Lord would keep this in your heart, that you will be faithful, that you would serve in the way that God has called you to, knowing that your service is not in vain. The Lord bless and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Let us all say together, amen.